2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 222, Reestablishing the Restoration. Participants Kathleen Flake and L. Rex Sears.
We'll be listening to Kathleen Flake, who's Assistant Professor of American Religious History at Vanderbilt University. She'll be offering a paper, Reestablishing the Restoration. Kathleen did her bachelor's degree at BYU and then became a lawyer. Right? And then saw the light and did an MA in religion at Catholic U in Washington, D.C., and did her PhD in American Religious History at the University of Chicago. The title of it was Mr. Smoot Goes to Washington, and in 2001 it won the award for best dissertation in Mormon history from the Mormon History Association. She's a primary teacher, teaches a CTR class in Nashville. So I teach at Western Carolina University, about 6 hours down the road from you. So we're both becoming Southerners. You eat grits yet?
Yes.
Okay. You're halfway there. Our respondent will be Rex Sayers, who did it the other way around, did a PhD in philosophy at Harvard. Wrote his dissertation an essay on philosophical Mormon theology, and then fell from grace and became a lawyer. Went to the University of Chicago and is practicing here in Salt Lake. He's got an article, there's an article in Dialogue that I read, but I can't remember the title of. He didn't put it down here for me. But he's got an article coming out in Utah Law Review, Punishing the Saints for Their Peculiar Institution. This was the outstanding paper for a student at the University of Chicago Law School. So I'm going to get out of the way and let these people take over.
In 1901, when Heber J. Grant heard that Joseph F. Smith was the new president of the church, he wrote a cousin, "I rejoice to think that Brother Joseph is now the prophet of the Lord on earth. I feel that his administration will be one of the most remarkable since the days of Prophet Joseph. Today, I hope to convince you, too, that Elder Grant was right. Joseph F. Smith was the most remarkable of prophets since the prophet. President Smith was, of course, the first member of the church's second generation to become its president. He was also the last of its presidents to personally know the prophet Joseph Smith, his uncle. Joseph F. was, however, more than a bridge. He was the architect for the 20th century church, and in many ways he was its savior. The same year that Joseph F. Smith became president of the church, Reed Smoot ran for and won a seat in the United States Senate. My dissertation deals with the aftermath of that election. To give you a sense of the scope of what followed, there was a Senate investigation initiated by the Salt Lake Ministerial Association, but it was joined in by virtually all the national reform associations and Protestant denominational voices. It created a 3,500-page transcript just from the hearing alone, which lasted intermittently for 4 years. The brouhaha about the election, though, lasted a full 6 years. A couple of questions arise, and these I try to deal with in my dissertation. I'm using this as an opportunity to talk about questions I think are of more interest to members of the church. The question, why Smoot was allowed to run at all, is an interesting one to me. B.H. Roberts had run for the House and won, but was not even allowed to take his seat in 1898. He was finally unceremoniously sent home, again without taking his seat, in 1900, the year before Smoot ran for the Senate. So the brethren were very aware of the dynamics in Washington when they sent Smoot. The other kind of question is, how did the church cope with this new wave of hostility and the compromises it required of them? And so those are the two questions you're going to hear talked about in this paper today. Little is said today about the difficulties the saints faced during the first quarter of the last century. We tend to think that President Woodruff's 1890 manifesto solved the worst of the church's problems with the nation. It is more accurate, however, to think that the manifesto is introducing another set of problems that came to a head during the administration of Joseph F. Given the time restraints today, I will discuss these problems in terms of two related crises. The first had to do with the church's reputation, as President Smith himself characterized it in 1901. Quote, "The people of the world have come to believe that we are the offscourings of the earth and scarcely fit to live," end of quote. Independent of how this made the saints feel, the practical result was that by the time President Smith took office, the church could not protect itself at home or abroad from hostile forces. The second crisis had to do with changes within the church, which had been percolating since 1890, but took effect under President Smith's leadership. It is hard for any religion to change and retain confidence in its capacity to faithfully mediate the divine. The essence of the divine is its unchanging nature, right? And so any church that changes is generally accused of not being true. And we'll talk about that some more in a minute. However, those churches that don't change die. The unmistakable vitality of the Latter-day Saint Church today is, I believe, in large part due to the prophetic reestablishment of the Restoration by Joseph F. Smith. But first, let me say a few words about the church's reputation as it entered the 20th century and the need for a reestablishment. When Smith took office in 1901, the Latter-day Saints were still universal objects of ridicule and scorn. Burlesque treatments and plays and romantic novels made the Mormon man the universal symbol of unrestrained and predatory sexuality, Mormon woman the dupe and sexual toy in a Rocky Mountain harem, and their children the abused and deformed offspring of an evil union. Mark Twain captures the less venomous spirit when he writes of his trip to Salt Lake City. He says, "There was fascination in surreptitiously staring at every creature we took to be a Mormon. This was a fairyland to us, a land of enchantment and goblins and awful mystery. We felt a fascination to ask every child how many mothers it had and if it could tell them apart. And we experienced a great thrill every time a dwelling house door opened, for we so longed to have a good, satisfying look at a Mormon family in all its comprehensive ampleness." End of quote. The Mormons were more than merely sexual and social curiosities, however. They were also considered a threat to stable government, both in the United States and Europe. Their family structure was believed to degrade the home, which was the foundation of democratic government. Priesthood organization especially was believed to undermine the liberty of individuals and institutions. Consequently, in the early 20th century, the church was perceived as a monopolistic and fascist threat to the republic that was then moving westward with its citizens. 11 new states lay beyond or along the Intermountain Corridor of the Rockies. 6 of them were the particular domain of the Mormons, and the remainder were subject to Mormon influence. At a time when electoral colleges determined the presidency and state legislators elected senators, Mormon pluralities could make the difference in national politics. Worse, because the Mormons had demonstrated a singular tendency to follow their own laws and not the nation's, the church had a reputation for anarchy during a period when labor battles and trust busting were on everyone's mind. A Gentile resident of Utah confirmed the fears of many when he told a Grand Rapids newspaper, quote, "At heart they are all traitors," end of quote. Antipathy towards the Mormons was sufficient to prevent B.H. Roberts from taking his seat. And then 2 years later, a similar campaign began against Weed Smoot. In addition to these problems nationally, which I mentioned earlier, the saints were losing control over their own political and economic domain in the Rocky Mountains. They had hoped statehood would bring them autonomy again, but it brought them democracy and pluralism instead. In his opus Great Basin Kingdom, Leonard Arrington concluded that by 1908, the self-sufficient Mormon kingdom may be said to have been brought to an end. A more acceptable, at least to the nation, more acceptable adjustment between spiritual and secular interests was attained. And with this adjustment, the church no longer offered a geographic and institutional alternative to Babylon. Faith became increasingly separated from community policy and religion from society. Individualism, speculation, and inequality, once thought to be characteristics of Babylon, were woven into the fabric of Mormon life. End of quote. These, then, were the years when Joseph F. Smith assumed responsibility for leading the church and, indeed, redefining the church to ensure that what Arrington calls the adjustment between spiritual and secular did not adjust the saints out of their faith. Joseph F. came to the office of president both uniquely able and uniquely disciplined to the task of making peace with the church's enemies. He was, as you know, born during the mob violence of Missouri in 1838. The stories of the brutal flight to Illinois informed his childhood. He watched the saints build their city beautiful out of a swamp and then abandon it to mobs. His youth did not spare him the terror of those days, however. When he visited Nauvoo in 1860, he wrote his first wife, quote, "I could pick out nearly every spot that I had known in childhood, and you may well suppose that thoughts rose to my mind that are easier felt than described. I stopped for a moment in front of where our old house stood and looked at the office, the barn, and the little brick outhouse, where I shut myself up to keep from going to prison, as I supposed. You have heard me speak of it, I think, often." End of quote. Of course, the saint's second involuntary exodus in 6 years was precipitated by the murder of his father and uncle in 1844, while in protective custody of the governor of Illinois. His mother died at the other end of the long trek across the Central Plains to the Rocky Mountains. Joseph F.'s character was formed in an environment of sacrifice, loss, and terror. The memory of the suffering remained fresh. On his 36th birthday, he wrote in his journal, quote, My soul has never thoroughly dispelled the darkening shadows cast upon it by the lowering gloom of that eventful period, end of quote. And so it was that, notwithstanding several trips to the area, it was not until the summer of 1906, in the middle of the Smoot hearings, indeed, after he had testified there, that he could bear going to Carthage. One who went with him says, quote, "I never shall forget how he sank down in a chair and wept in the little jail room where his father had been killed," end of quote. When throughout his appearance in the Smoot hearing, President Smith wore on his left lapel a button with his martyred father's picture, it was a reminder of who he was and his conviction that no sacrifice was too great for the cause. It also may give some insight into Joseph F.'s opinion of the Senate tribunal and his expectations of government custody on the witness stand. Joseph F.'s maturation in the Utah County, in Utah Territory, was no less eventful than his childhood. He arrived in the Great Basin in 1847 after his mother's death, supported himself and his siblings as a teamster, plowboy, logger, and general roustabout, sent on a mission at the age of 15 because he had beaten a teacher for trying to corporally punish his sister. He returns and that night spends his time, as he says, molding rifle bullets from pig lead. "I then proceeded to the front." It was 1847 in the Utah War. For the next 50 years, he was at the front in every battle the church fought with its host nation. It is ironic, then, that Joseph F. would be the one to demand that his people make peace with the nation. In his inaugural sermon to the assembled church, he announced that the time had come to make friends of their enemies. He said, "There are thousands and thousands of innocent people in the world whose minds have become so darkened by the slanderous reports that have gone forth concerning us that they would feel they are doing God's service to deprive a member of this church of life or of liberty or the pursuit of happiness if they could do it. The Lord designs to change this condition of things." In short, his conclusion was that the nation's antipathy was jeopardizing the church's millennial mission, both inhibiting the gathering of Israel and the establishment of Zion. The most obvious example of what concerned President Smith was the crippling effect of anti-Mormonism on the church's missions. In the American South, especially, missionaries and new members were victims of mob violence, death threats, even murder at times. Meanwhile, European governments, in cooperation with the United States State Department, were proscribing the organization of LDS congregations and deporting LDS missionaries. President Smith also mentioned he was concerned about establishing the next generation of the church in this environment. Most immediately, there was a risk of the nationalization of the Testo statute from Idaho, which had disenfranchised church members for their belief in polygamy, not their being polygamous. It was not inconceivable that the pogroms of the 1870s would be reinstated. Given this view of the church's future, it is not difficult to understand why President Smith wanted an apostle in the Senate. While Roberts' experience was a reminder of the one set of negatives, they paled in comparison to the church's present vulnerabilities. Thus, while Joseph F. had participated in virtually every battle of the church, with his inaugural sermon, he signals his intention to wage peace, and Smoot was a critical element of that battle. The conflict of sentiments ran deep, however, and I'm going to just skip this because time is running short and I want to leave time for questions. But it seems to me, as I've read his sermons over these years, that one of the more remarkable elements of it is his demand that the church forgive the Gentiles for the experiences they had had with them in the previous century. And when you think that he's talking to people who are not reading this as a matter of history, but personal experience, the jailing in extraordinarily barbaric conditions in Yuma Prison and in Detroit and these various jails, whose parents, some of them, and certainly their grandparents, many of them had been murdered or maimed and lost all their worldly possessions. So all this is, if not personal experience, recent memory. And Job Smith says to them, "I want to say to you Latter-day Saints who harbor a feeling of unforgiveness in their souls are more guilty and more censurable than the one who has sinned against them. Go home and dismiss envy and hatred from your hearts. I do not care whether that malice is borne towards a member of the church or not. You are to forgive them." And one measure of Joseph F. Smith's success as a leader during this period is the extent to which not only we, but also our former enemies, have forgotten why this message was necessary in its own day. Regardless, while the church no doubt wanted a cessation of the violence, it should be remembered that President Smith's motivation was not simply peace, but prosperity. The ultimate object of the church in the early 20th century lay beyond the continental United States. Hence, the redesigning of the church during these years was more than a defensive strategy. It was an opportunistic preparation of its message for a larger audience. For Joseph F. Smith, this was the church's divine mandate. Quote, "The kingdom of God is here to grow, to spread abroad, never more to be destroyed or to cease, but to continue until the purposes of the Almighty shall be accomplished, every word that has been spoken by the mouths of the holy prophets since the world began." End of quote. At the very time the United States was extending its sovereignty beyond the borders, beyond its borders, and it exercising its diplomatic influence in the internal politics of foreign nations, the church also was beginning to internationalize. This determination to seat Apostle Smoot was integral to its initiative. While many objected to the negative attention it attracted and accused Reed Smoot of vain ambition, Joseph F. Smith was unwavering in his support. To one who suggested Smoot not stand for re-election, Smith said, quote, "In the most forceful," this is quoting from the man's journal, it's actually Bishop Nibley, "in the most forceful and positive manner," President Smith said, quote, "if ever the Spirit of the Lord has manifested to men anything clear and plain and positive, it is this, that Reed Smoot should remain in the United States Senate. He can do more good there than he can anywhere else." This was proven in 1823 when Smoot, as an apostle, was called on a mission with junior apostle John A. Widtso to go to the nations of Northern Europe and negotiate the church back in. And when he went there, he was chair of the Senate Finance Committee and on the War Reparations Committee, and was entertained by the kings of Europe as well as the great publishing magnates of, for example, Britain. He said to Lord Beaverbrook to stop publishing anti-Mormon materials, and he began to do so. And so it was an extraordinary mission. The saints needed the protection of U.S. law and the benefit of American status as they began to organize an institutional structure in Europe, Asia, and Latin America. Its intention to grow had motivated the church to come finally to the bargaining table on its own initiative and renegotiate its identity within the American Republic. And this is something that's often overlooked in histories of the Latter-day Saint Church. The church resisted any effort and all effort to get it to abandon polygamy until it had a higher objective in mind. That higher objective, when it saw its purpose, its millennial mission, being hampered by its resistance to American law, it sacrificed the one to the other. And it was a sacrifice for what they deemed to be a greater good. Though it should never be understood that Joseph F. Smith did not have a very strong conviction of polygamy. His own conviction was that the saints had lost the opportunity to practice it because they had not lived it properly. So that renegotiation of interest between the Mormon church and the nation, however, affected not only what others thought of the saints, but how they thought of themselves. The distancing of the church from its commitment to the principle of plural marriage was an arduous and agonizing process that cut to the heart of how the saints understood the restoration of the gospel. And this is hard for modern Latter-day Saints to perceive because we have so completely marginalized this belief in polygamy, not just the practice, but we've so marginalized the belief in polygamy that we have forgotten how integral it was to Mormon doctrine. This is obvious if only one thinks of the sacrifice the saints had made to live this last great initiative of the prophet Joseph Smith. It is more obvious if one considers that to remove faith in one revelation can undermine faith in all revelation, even the revelator. The effect of the manifesto had always been compromised by the widespread assumption that it was a political expediency to which members were not accountable except politically. Thus, while the church had been drawn along the path to abandoning celestial marriage since the manifesto in 1890, President Smith's dismissal in 1905 of two apostles for their practice of polygamy intensified to an heretofore unknown degree the need to obtain the saints' confidence in church leadership. So there was the confusion in the rank and file of the church and the leadership about whether polygamy was or was not permissible. Generally, the conviction was that it was permissible, that these statements were simply said to the world to protect the church. When, during the Smoot hearings, that confusion increased, there was also organizationally a lack of coherence in the process. Many stake presidents, some patriarchs, had been given the keys to perform sealing so that the brethren could, in the apostolic quorum, but certainly the first presidency, could preserve their deniability in the questioning process that they were continually put through by newspapers as well as representatives of the government. So control was a real problem here, and faith was right behind that issue of control. Conveniently, 1905 was also the centennial anniversary of the birth of the prophet whose status was in crisis. The dedication that same year of a monument to Joseph Smith provided the occasion for identifying what about him and his legacy mattered to the church and what would be carried forward into the 20th century to provide it with continuing confidence in both the original prophet and his 20th century successors. On December 18, 1905, 3 days after agreeing to make final John W. Taylor and Matthias Cowley's forced resignations, President Joseph F. Smith gathered what was left of the senior leadership of the church. And I say what's left because George Teasdale's in hiding in Mexico. Heber J. Grant's in exile in England. Cowley and Taylor have just been taken out of the quorum. And similar problems. But anyway, so it's just what's left of the quorum. All commemorations of a shared past, now this is important, all commemorations of a shared past are comprised of remembering and forgetting. Not just remembering. Commemorations have to do with what is commemorated out as well as what is commemorated in. Okay? So as one historian put it, people develop a shared identity by identifying, exploring, and agreeing on memories. In the course of taking a picture or creating an album, they decide what they want to remember and how they want to remember it. In 1905, the saints were about to turn the American landscape into their scrapbook, their family album. During Joseph Smith's administration, the church began to recover and reconstruct all those sites that you know about now. The saints felt the need for places of memory at the very time when they felt at risk of a breach with their past. The Utah Church's claim to a piece of Vermont constituted a collective act of remembering, which helped them forget a past they could not carry with them into the future. They would be so successful that eventually they would hardly be aware that they were agreeing to forget, and if made aware, would tend to think they were forgetting Brigham Young. In fact, they were in the process of forgetting portions of Joseph Smith's legacy, which Young had taken so literally. Leaving the overt historicizing to others, Joseph F. Smith spoke during the ceremonies only to dedicate the monument. His prayer stipulated the elements of Joseph Smith's mission, which would be carried forward into the 20th century as inviolable, even to the consciousness of change. Thanking God for, quote, the great prophet and seer of the 19th century, Joseph F. Smith made an offering of each element of the monument in terms of its significance. The huge cement foundation symbolized the primitive church, he said. Upon this foundation was laid a 4-foot-thick, 30-ton granite base, quote, typifying the rock of revelation, end of quote. Finally, erected on the base and measuring a foot for each year of his life, a 38.5-foot shaft of granite represented Joseph Smith himself. The shaft was polished to symbolize Joseph Smith's, quote, reflecting the light of heaven, quote, and was crowned to illustrate Smith's successful completion of his mission and the possibility for all to be similarly glorified. these three elements: a foundational restoration of Christ's church from apostasy, a base of continuing revelation from heaven, and an assertion of Joseph Smith's revelatory power and divine authority bestowed on those that follow, are the core elements of LDS doctrine and today frame the church's identity. In place of its 19th century theocratic and familial kingdom building, the church was prepared by crisis to return to less grandiose but still large claims regarding restoration of the primitive church, divine sponsorship, and living prophets. These principles constitute the generative and hence non-negotiable core of Mormonism. They were carved in stone both literally on the surface of the Joseph Smith Monument and figuratively in terms of the church's identity. Indeed, it is in Joseph F. Smith's effort to adapt the church to the progressive era's demand for change that one most clearly sees that these issues of revealed knowledge and restored authority constitute the creative and untouchable core of LDS belief and identity. In addition to being inscribed on the Joseph Smith Monument, these core principles were taught to the saints through the Joseph Smith story. Those historians who have considered the subject agree, in the words of James Allen, that, quote, the weight of evidence would suggest that the first vision was not a matter of common knowledge, even among church members in the earliest years of Mormon history, end of quote. Now, that's just inconceivable to most of us today. In fact, not until Joseph F. Smith's presidency did the first vision move to the fore of LDS self-representation. At the direction of Joseph F., the text of Joseph Smith's autobiography was divided into chapters and verses and integrated by reference to the rest of LDS scripture. This served to give Joseph Smith's first vision status equal to the visions of biblical and Book of Mormon prophets. The successful formalization of Smith's first vision and its placement at the core of LDS identity is neatly summarized by one of those called to fill the vacancies created by the dismissal of Taylor and Cowley. Quoting again, the appearing of the Father and the Son to Joseph Smith is the foundation of this church. Not the Book of Mormon, not those other elements that you hear in the 19th century. Therein lies the secret of its strength and vitality. Don't you see what that means? What God is answered. His relation to his children is clear. His interest in humanity through authority delegated to man is apparent. The future of this work is assured, end of quote. The assurance provided by the first vision was in no small part due to its synthesis of those ideas so necessary to LDS faith. In that story, you have each of those three principles illuminated: an immanent God, modern revelation, and divine imprimatur of ecclesiastical authority. The 20th century role of Joseph Smith's autobiography can only be appreciated, however, when it is viewed as a narrative, even a story of origins capable of reordering the reader's experience of time. The saints had a particular need for ordering during Joseph F. Smith's administration, and so it is that during these years, Smith's autobiography emerges not only as a source of doctrine, but as the modern church's master narrative. The Joseph Smith story is first used in Sunday school texts in 1905, in priesthood instructional manuals in 1909, as a separate missionary tract in 1910, and in histories of the church in 1912. In the first vision, Joseph F. Smith had found a marker of LDS identity whose pedigree was as great and would be made greater than that of plural marriage for the 20th century saints. The church's new emphasis on the Joseph Smith story effectively strengthened Joseph Smith's status as a prophet during a time when abandonment of polygamy threatened to undermine the faithful's confidence in him. Now, much more could be said and should be said, and I want to leave time for your questions and for Rex's response, so let me just end by saying that much that could be said is all that we take for granted. He began the public relations initiative of the church by organizing the Bureau of Information and the construction of a hotel suitable for entertaining visitors. Think of the Olympics here. He centralized church government and constructed a new headquarters building still in use today. His initiatives helped mainstream the once scandalous Mormon family through such programs as weekly family home evenings and the Boy Scouts. Joseph F. Smith's presidency was also marked by his confidence in explicating doctrines such as the official statements defining the LDS concept of God, of the Godhead. And of course, Joseph F. Smith became the only LDS president other than his uncle to have a vision included in LDS scripture. In sum, what he said of what he, Joseph F., said of his predecessor, Lorenzo Snow, on the anniversary of Snow's death was no less and possibly more true of Joseph F. himself. And I'm quoting here. I say, all honor and praise be to that instrument in the hands of God for establishing order in the midst of uncertainty and certain rules by which we know our bearings. I wish to mention this because I feel in my heart to thank the Lord for President Snow and to honor him as the instrument in his hands of accomplishing his mission for which the Lord preserved so long in life. We should likewise thank the Lord for President Joseph F. Smith and honor him as an instrument in the Lord's hands, because the church that he reestablished is the only church we know. Thank you.
Let me start with a couple isolated comments, and then after that, a few more developed observations. First, just as a note that might be useful to keep in mind, when we move into a question and answer, particularly given Kathleen's comments about Apostle Smoot as a senator, I think it's also just worth keeping in mind that Smoot was more useful because he was a Republican and because he was a monogamist, whereas Roberts was a Democrat and a polygamist, and it was... Kathleen can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but...
That's the only reason we got in.
Okay. Both the Republican and the monogamy?
Well, Joseph F. was a Republican and was very mad at the Democrats because they had allowed that Idaho Testo statute to be ratified.
As part of the Idaho Constitution.
After Idaho, Joseph F. abandoned the Democrats and was intent upon turning the church Republican.
Yeah.
And remember, the nation was Republican at that time.
Right.
And that was a political exchange.
And the Mormons had been largely Democrat through the 19th century, but... Yeah. And they also seemed to have an easier time cutting a deal with the Republicans than the Democrats. Once they got the... It took more work to cut a deal with the Republicans, but the Republicans were a little bit more proactive in securing
the
position. Second, quick observation... There's a passage that Kathleen skipped in the interest of time that I wish she hadn't, because I really liked it, so I'm going to read it just so you have it as well. The saints had always tried to balance their love of the Constitution with their rage over their losses. Their new president, however, demanded a more positive offering from his church to the nation, namely forgiveness. I thought that was a very nice passage, and so I hope you don't mind me reading it. Third of these four scattered observations, this is another memorable passage, but one that you might want to think about editing in light of recent political developments. You refer to the turn of the 20th century as a time when electoral colleges determined the presidency, and you imply that that's no longer the case. last... Kathleen referred to opportunistic repackaging as a process. She characterized some of what Joseph F. did as an opportunistic repackaging to help the church grow and expand. An ongoing precedent, I would say, in church administration. It's been suffered. Well, I was about to say suffered. I guess that's the wrong word. Has certainly found new adherents in recent decades. Anyway, moving on to my more detailed comments, I think Kathleen has done an excellent job of describing both key challenges faced by Joseph F.'s administration and how he dealt with them. Kathleen notes that the saints found it necessary to renegotiate their relationship with Babylon, and that the process of renegotiation necessitated accompanying changes of how we thought about ourselves. Now, Kathleen found it necessary, given time, to restrict her focus to two crises. Since I'm just the respondent, I'll restrict my focus to just one of those two crises. My comments will focus on the latter crisis, Mormonism's changing self-perception. I do not think it is possible to engage in a careful reading of our history without realizing that the church of today is very different from the 19th century church, and that the most significant changes had already taken place by the time the Great War ended in 1918. From 1890 to 1918, the church shed the doctrines of polygamy and the political kingdom, what Kathleen referred to as our 19th century theocratic and familial kingdom building, that ever since the Exodus to Utah had been the defining characteristics of Mormonism for saints and Gentiles alike.
In the process, certain related doctrines, like Adam God, were deprived of their context and were revised or abandoned. Kathleen captures the crisis these changes precipitated with the observation, quote, "It is hard for any religion to change and retain confidence in its capacity to faithfully mediate the divine," close quote. But change was not new to the Restoration. Thomas Alexander and others have described the evolution in basic Mormon theology from the Book of Mormon to the Nauvoo era, and scholars like Michael Quinn, David Berger, and Gregory Prince have chronicled accompanying developments in priesthood doctrines. Apparently, Brigham Young was not overly troubled by what he may well have recognized as departures from Mormonism's earliest scriptures. In an address Brigham delivered on July 13, 1862, he explained that, quote, "When God speaks to the people, he does it in a manner to suit their circumstances and capacities." In the same address, he said that should the Lord Almighty send an angel to rewrite the Bible, it would in many places be very different from what it is now, because God spoke to the children of Jacob through Moses as a blind, stiff-necked people, and when Jesus and his apostles came, they talked with the Jews as a benighted, wicked, selfish people. And the Lion of the Lord went on to venture, quote, "that if the Book of Mormon were now to be rewritten, in many instances, it would materially differ from the present translation." According to Brigham Young, God was hampered in what he could reveal to the early church, and perhaps even to Joseph in his earliest years, because they had to be prepared before they could or would receive the fullness. Now, Kathleen noted that to remove faith in one revelation can undermine faith in all revelation, even the revelator. Of arguably greater importance, to undermine faith in Mormonism's first revelator can undercut confidence in his successors to the prophetic mantle. More generally, if we acknowledge that our prophets have disagreed in their prophetic pronouncements, the conclusion that prophets must be fallible seems inescapable. One or the other of them has to be wrong. Brigham Young's explanation for why even the scriptures can change over time avoids this crisis of confidence because on that model, while each Mormon revelator might disagree with something his predecessors taught, we have a principled reason for believing that their disagreements with one another notwithstanding, our prophets are generally reliable, and each revelator is even more reliable than his forerunners. Namely, each prophet improves on what has come before, each has a better view of the truth because each stands on his predecessor's shoulders, and builds on their earlier development of Mormon heterodoxy. The explanation I attribute to Young works well as long as doctrine evolves on a consistent trajectory away from orthodoxy. As long as Mormon beliefs kept getting weirder, each new innovation could be explained as something the people had only just been prepared to receive by their recent acceptance of some prior heresy. But Joseph F. faced the problem not just of changing church doctrine, but backtracking. In abandoning polygamy in the political kingdom, the church was surrendering key departures from mainstream Christianity, retracing at least some of its steps back into the fold. And Brigham Young's explanation does not work well for retractions. Once a revelator announces a departure from his predecessor's teachings in an orthodox direction, it becomes clear that either the earlier revelator or the later revelator got it wrong, and lingering bondage to the dead traditions of our fathers cannot explain away the earlier revelator's mistake. Joseph F. could not use Brigham Young's model of change to explain post-manifesto developments, so he had to develop a new approach. Joseph F. could have resolved the new crisis of retraction in at least two ways. First, he could have admitted that sometimes prophets get it wrong, not because they are moving in the right direction but haven't yet gone far enough, but just because they make mistakes. The first Joseph Smith to lead the Restoration occasionally made statements along those lines, which are sometimes repeated to rebut the charge that we think the prophet is infallible. But while the general pronouncements bear, albeit infrequent, repetition, I have yet to hear a church leader say that our current prophet might be mistaken about anything in particular. While Mormonism does not formally claim a doctrine of prophetic infallibility, the notion that our prophet cannot be mistaken seems to be part of what Elder Packer has called the unwritten order of things. It bears mention in this connection that Brigham Young's explanation of inadequacies in old doctrinal pronouncements likewise shields the current prophet from criticism and questioning by church membership. Brigham recognized that teachings do change. Nevertheless, he insisted that in the face of conflict, the current prophet is always more to be believed because each revelator moves us further and further from the dead traditions of our fathers to the living gospel. Our current prophet's teachings, it's true, might likewise be superseded, but not because he is simply mistaken, he just hasn't gone far enough yet. Rather than formally endorse a doctrine of prophetic fallibility, Joseph F. chose another option, which seems to remain the preferred method of dealing with doctrinal evolution to this day. Rather than acknowledge and face earlier mistakes, thereby legitimizing the inference that sometimes our prophets, past and present, get it wrong, Joseph F. denied that the earlier mistakes were made. This approach was perhaps most clear with Adam God, where Joseph F. and his administration championed the thesis that Brigham Young had just been misinterpreted by disingenuous critics of the church. In keeping with this new strategy, Joseph F. insisted that the scriptures, far from being outdated by subsequent developments, were indeed the standards of the church, which can be appealed to as authority in doctrine. Brigham Young's explanation of change enabled an easy approach to the scriptures. If the scriptures appear to say something contrary to current teachings, the appearance is most likely correct, and is to be explained by the fact that those scriptures were written by people who had not advanced as far as we. But with Joseph F.'s new approach of denying
observation on that. The question about how the church membership could deal with their prophet saying, oh, I don't get revelation. If you look at public reaction, if you look at reaction in the church to President Hinckley's statements in various media outlets to the effect of, oh, I wouldn't really say what the Lorenzo Snow couplet is, God as man as God once was. When President Hinckley says that, the membership of the church generally quite easily says, oh, well, that's intended for the outsiders. There might be something instructive in that.
Well, I didn't say repackaging. I said the decision to negotiate with the government was opportunistic, to engage in the Smoot hearings at all, to allow Smoot to run, and to go through the conniption fits they did for the next 4 years was opportunistic. I didn't call it repackaging. I call it a reestablishment. I think that institutions that don't know their essence and attempt to go through these crises, these decision points, often fail at them. And the Latter-day Saints, the Utah Mormons, succeeded in 1905 in going through a very critical passage because they knew what their essence was. And their essence was not plural marriage, as important as that was to them. Their essence was the gathering of Israel to the covenant in preparation for the second coming of Christ. That is the essence of the Utah Church. And you can see that they are on point, that the brethren have followed that ball throughout the 20th century, as they did in the 19th. All right, how conscious are they of this? Well, this is the question of inspiration versus strategy. And it just depends on what kind of credit you want to give them. Either way, you have to give them credit. Okay? You either have to give them credit for being inspired beyond what anybody could imagine in terms of what they pulled off in the first decade of the 20th century. Or they were just really smart. I think they were both myself, but I tend to think the former. I think he was as inspired as his uncle was. Because I don't think he could have known what that the power of narrative until Paul Ricoeur spelled it out for us. You know?
If Kathleen mentioned the two alternatives, inspired or very smart, I would just mention that there are, within the Mormon tradition, as particularly exemplified by the fundamentalists, people who would say, well, they might have been smart, but that didn't mean they weren't wicked for doing what they did, however smart it was. I'm not signing off on that, just noting that there is that reaction.
That was a critical question during the course of the hearings, and they dealt with it in two ways. One, there were many secret societies in America during this period. So people were used to secret societies. As to the oath itself, They were able to introduce into the record that was based on a passage of scripture from the book of Revelations that these good Protestants believed in themselves. And most fundamentally, there was when they would examine the Latter-day Saint witnesses about it, they would say, is this the oath? And they'd all say, well, we're not free to say. And they say, well, and then eventually got around to, but aside from believing in this, have you ever done this? And all of them would say no. And so in practical effect, they were able to dismiss it as spirituality, right? It was basically a spiritual belief or conviction that did not trouble them. It wasn't what the Mormons said during the trial that convinced the Senate that they would obey American law. They did not believe the Mormons. By the first decade of the 20th century, nobody believed the Mormons on polygamy. The church had to do something. And the function of the hearing, again, was to so beat up the brethren that they went back and realized the game was up, that they had to do something. And so in 1904, they tried the Second Manifesto, but nobody believes that either. So in 1905, after trying everything, they do something. They ask two brethren to fall on their swords. And they did. They had quorum meetings, and they said, this is your choice. This is what we'd like you to do. I mean, you can read there's a transcript available. No, that was not the way they put it to them. Now, it may have come to that. And they clearly couched it in terms of this was their duty for the good of the church. That if they had the well-being of the church in mind, this is what they would do. They would sign these resignation letters. And there's no question that that's what Francis Lyman wanted from them and that those resignations were written for them. But the discussion was consistent with the principles on which the Quorum of the Twelve operates, with its authority, vis-a-vis the First Presidency. But no, there's no question that if they had stood their ground and said no, it would have had to go through another cycle of pressure. But, nonetheless, it was when they did something, when the church actually fired two of its most popular and powerful disciples, that the government said, okay, we believe you now.
So here, there, we've got 5 minutes, so let's do this quickly.
I have a question concerning Joseph Smith's relationship with Francis Lyman after the Little Manifesto. Apparently, Joseph S. Smith continued to permit, or himself maybe he solemnized, a few plural marriages after the Little Manifesto. At the same time, the Francis Lyman was charging ahead on his mission to stop all these new marriages. What was the interaction between these two brothers during that time period?
Lyman was in support of the Second Manifesto and took it on its face to mean what it said. There's some question whether Joseph F. Smith did mean it. All of that is interpretive. I think it's true that Joseph F. Smith did not mean any more by the Second Manifesto than Wilford Woodruff meant by the first. So what was the nature of the relationship between the two men? I think it was probably as it had always been. Because Lyman's devotion to the Second Manifesto was consistent with his devotion to the first. So it's not just how they talked to each other after the Second Manifesto, but what was the nature of the relationship among the brethren after 1890 on this issue. And as for Joseph F. Sanctioning further marriages, then you have to parse that word sanction. Again, the authority to perform marriages was attenuated. Some stake presidents and patriarchs had authority to do that. It didn't require Joseph F. Smith saying, you can do this at that point. I think it's doubtful that he approved any marriages after 1904, but I'd have to go back and look at Michael Quinn's research on this. I think, which is not to say he was opposed to plural marriage, but I doubt that he personally said, go do this to anybody, go seal somebody after 1904. And Lyman's point was, to his brethren, he would keep saying, and this is what Joseph F. said, too, you cannot make me a liar, so you better stop doing this, because I've testified to this in the Senate, so don't make me a liar. So you 12, stop performing these marriages after 1904.
Well, I forget the name, but there was one specific plural marriage that Joseph F. Smith did perform.
This is Abraham O'Cannon? It was Abraham O'Cannon, and it was prior to the Smoot hearings.
Okay, we're going to have to move on to the next question.
I got a short question. In the Smoot hearings,
Well, there were, to the extent that people could get access to it through those who had left the church. I'm trying to remember whether it was introduced as an exhibit to the hearing or not. Do you know, Rex? It wasn't? Yeah. There were statements that were introduced into the record, and Charles Moyston Owen posed in temple clothing in the New York papers, and there were rallies in which the ceremony was walked through, but it was never part of the official record of the Senate hearing.
It was printed in the Salt Lake Tribune in 1904.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so other sources, but not the Senate hearing itself.
Okay, one last question.
If forum hearing has been out for the gathering, what is the highest purpose for gathering?
Gathering, well, it wasn't given up.
But we don't gather like
they do. They don't gather to Utah, but how do you understand the building of temples? Joe Smith said, why does the Lord gather his people? To build temples. So what you're seeing in the late 20th century with temple building is the other shoe dropping on this organization of stakes throughout the world. And that's the gathering of Israel.
Okay, I want to thank our presenters.
Can I ask for misinformation to members? There was always a cognoscenti in the church. Yes. Thank you, Marilyn.